It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Remember the first time you saw a piece of art that shocked you?
I grew up in Baltimore watching movies like Maniac and Olga's House of Shame and the Rex Theater. And that's kind of how I grew up. And then underground movies at the same time, which I would run away to New York and see in lofts. And police would raid it and bust the projectionist and take half the audience away. I mean, that's when you go to the movies and something happens.
Film director John Waters.
I'm William Castle. I feel obligated to warn you about the next attraction you will see at this theater. The picture is The Tingler.
The Tingler was a thing that lived inside you, and it got bigger and bigger when you were frightened, and the only way to kill it was to scream.
Ladies and gentlemen, please do not panic.
And in the movie, the Tingler gets loose in a movie theater, and then they stop and said,
"The Tingler is loose in this theater. Scream for your life."
And then buzzers went off under your seats. And when I finally went to the Towson Theater and it would finally play there, they only would wire like three or four seats, you know, but I'd go in and find those seats and just sit there. Screaming cinema, mayhem and anarchy. I've always wanted to be able to reproduce that. So there was, of course, Smell-O-Vision that came out, and then mine was Odorama, which was pizza, dirty feet, farts. When they did the cards later for DVD, the company wouldn't do it. They said, "We can't be having encouraging young people to sniff glue." I did sniff glue. It works.
Today we're talking about shock value, the virtues of transgressive, subversive, rule-breaking art as an aesthetic and also as a way of life. Performance artist Marina Abramović will be joining us. She has invited audiences to kick, punch, stab, burn, or shoot her, and she once turned herself into a display at MoMA. For 700 hours, she sat in a chair while 750,000 museum-goers took turns staring at her. But first, Pablo Picasso said good taste is the enemy of great art, and filmmaker John Waters has a corollary. Bad taste is what entertainment is all about. He also says that if someone vomits while watching one of his movies, he considers it the equivalent of a standing ovation. Maybe not the kind of guy you hope your kid will adopt as a role model. So what possessed the Rhode Island School of Design to invite him to give a commencement address?
Okay, I'm supposed to inspire you. How's this? Somehow, I've been able to make a living doing what I love best for 50 years without ever having to get a real job. But how can you be so disciplined, friends always ask, when I tell them my job is to get up every day at 6 a.m., Monday to Friday, and think up insane stuff? Easy. If I didn't work this hard for myself, I'd have to go work for somebody else. Plus, I can go to my office one room away from my bedroom in my own house, dressed in my underpants if I want to. You're lucky. When I went to school, my teachers discouraged every dream I ever had. I wanted to be the filthiest person alive, but no school would let me. I bet RISD would have. You could possibly even make a snuff movie here and get an A+. Hopefully, you have been taught never to fear rejection in the workplace. Remember, a no is free. Ask for the world and pay no mind if you were initially turned down. A career in the arts is like a hitchhiking trip. All you need is one person to say, "Get in," and off you go. And then the confidence begins.
And now John Waters has turned that commencement address into a book called Make Trouble, with illustrations by Eric Hansen. Doug Gordon sat down to find out more.
What honorary degree did the RISD bestow upon you?
Well, it was for the arts. And I think I had gotten one time when I taught at a prison in Maryland. Patuxent Institute, and this was in the 80s, you had to have a degree. So they gave me a lifetime degree, of which just means that you're crazy and didn't go to school and got attention. So I guess I got some kind of degree so I could teach in prison, because they got real graduation and everything. And this one was more like when they give the Wizard of Oz the brain and the end of the Wizard of Oz when they hand that paper. So it was kind of like that. And then I went to a dinner, and it was great. I was very proud of it. The whole thing was great. And since then, I got another honorary degree, and I had big retrospectives. I got a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Writers Guild. It's great. It's like being at your own funeral and getting to hear the eulogies while you're still alive.
Like Tom Sawyer, yeah. And where he's got to hear all the eulogies at his own funeral.
So it's good.
Yeah, it's great. How did you decide what you wanted to say to them? Was that something you struggled with, being that this was the first commencement address you'd done?
I don't think it was a struggle. I think I've always been a filth elder, and I think I've been counseling kids how to be juvenile delinquents in a proper way for years. So it came pretty naturally. It took me a couple days to write it. I read it to a friend of mine. He said, well, I don't know. You better run that one past somebody else. Because all the things I write, I always think, well, they can go either way, you know?
Yeah.
And lately, nobody gets mad at anything I say, and I probably say stuff today that is even probably maybe more controversial than I did when I started. So I don't know. Things have obviously changed. I think that's because you stick around long enough, they can't get rid of you, and they start to respect you. So I'm thrilled with it all. I think they treated me very, very fairly there. I was honored to get the degree. Ever since, I've been prescribing OxyContin. I've been abusing it. I demand tenure. I've become ruthless. You know, once you get in academia, it's a cutthroat world.
You should start your own school, the John Waters School of Filmmaking.
Well, you know, I was literally, and this is true, I was offered at one time to start a reform school for kids.
Really?
And these were the people I worked in the prisons with. And I liked the idea only because it would be the John Waters Reform School. So parents would say, if you're not good, yeah, you're going to John Waters. But yeah, I would have had to give up everything else to do this. You know, it would have been a full-time job. But you never know. I always have a lot of backup careers. So Warden is another one that I might do later in life.
Warden Waters. That's nice. Very alliterative. I like it.
All boys are bad boys. Yeah. That'd be the opposite of Father Flanagan.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a good boy.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask you about a few of the many wise things that you said in your speech. One thing you said is you need to prepare sneak attacks on society. Can you give me an example of one of the sneak attacks you have made on society?
Yeah, hairspray. Who would have ever thought that it would play in every high school in America and it's two men singing a love song to each other? It is basically a musical that encourages your white daughter to date black guys. There's a whole song about that.
Timeless to me.
Wilbur, let's take this upstairs.
You're timeless to me.
So I think it was a sneak attack. It was a Trojan horse, and nobody to this day still realizes it.
Well, now they do because you've admitted it.
Yeah, but nobody ever objects. No parents ever seem to be upset about hairspray. And that's because it's not mean. And that's why I tell everybody the only way you can change anybody's mind is to make them laugh, not preach, not get on a soapbox, not be holier than thou, not be a separatist, not say, oh, I'm leaving the country, all that. Who cares if you leave the country? So, I mean, basically, I think it was a sneak attack. Pink Flamingos was certainly preaching to the converted, and hairspray was the only devious movie I ever made.
Yeah. Was that intentional? Were you planning on that? Was that cool?
No, it was an accident. Yeah. I mean, when I made Hairspray, I didn't think, oh, this is going to be a commercial one or anything.
Yeah.
And I remember when we got the PG rating, I thought I would never work again. And even New Line at the time wanted me to put one four-letter word in so we'd get a PG-13. Uh-huh. But I said, that's not so shocking. Let's have the shock be that it is a movie for the whole family with Divine as the star.
That's very subversive. I like that. You told these young people at the Rhode Island School of Design that contemporary art's job is to wreck what came before.
Sure, it is. I mean, think about it. Pop art ended abstract expressionism. Minimalism tried to end pop art. rap maybe ended punk. Punk ended the Beatles. I think every new thing that comes along has to wreck what comes before it. And contemporary art does hate you if you have contempt before investigation. You have to like it before it hates you.
And you've done a fair share of wrecking contemporary art in your career, right?
Well, joyful wrecking, certainly. Pink Flamingos was a terrorist attack on the tyranny of good taste, yes.
Mm-hmm. Another thing you told the graduates was to use technology for transgression, not lazy social living. I think I have a hunch of what you're saying there, but I'd like you to spell it out for me, what you're talking about with that one.
Yeah, hack and find out what porn Trump rents. Don't never go out of your house or get dressed because you're on Facebook all day.
Yeah.
And I'm for Facebook. I'm not against any of these things. I mean, it's not like I'm a Luddite. You know, I'm not on Facebook because I want to be harder to reach. Anybody that I cared about from my past, I've stalked their homes years ago. I don't need to find where they are. I'm not interested in what you had for lunch.
No.
I work 10-hour days as it is. And also, tweeting, I'm not giving away my material for free. I have a spoken word show. I have to write books. I need to bank my material. I'm not giving it away every day. No, but who's going to pay you?
Yeah, I don't even care what I had for lunch, so why should you or anyone else? How did the graduates and their parents respond to your speech?
They seemed very well. I couldn't tell. They laughed a lot. But one time when I started talking to the parents and said, these ungrateful brats, do they think you're made of money? They cheered, and I didn't realize all the parents sit in one section because I heard this whole side of the room really cheer. And I think nobody ever talks to the parents in a truthful way at commencement speeches. They're all so holier than thou. So I said to the parents, you know, what did they expect you to understand everything overnight? Can't they give you a second to adjust to such social changes as sexual reassignment surgery, horn implants, and the political rights of the adult baby community?
Yeah, I love the horn implants line.
Well, I've seen people with horns a lot. They get them implanted now. I think it's nice if you're a little devilish little goth girl or something.
I just wanted to see what you thought of this idea I had about a way to bring back the drive-in movie theater.
Yeah, now they should be able to do them because of digital. You can see it so well outside, so much better than it
used to be. Well, yeah, but what do you think about this idea? What about doing a mashup combining the Demolition Derby and the drive-in theater? You know, people watch a movie, they get their autoerotic thrills by smashing and bashing their cars into one another. You know, it's foreplay with Fords.
While they're watching a movie?
It's GM meets S&M, yeah. They watch it.
I guess maybe you'd have that at in between the films. Instead of visit at the concession stand, you'd have to go into a separate part.
It makes it extreme, yeah. Though. Imagine, like, that never has a visit to the concession stand been so dangerous.
It's intermission time.
As you leave the theater, folks, please be careful. Don't let this happen to your car.
The walk to the concession stand, I always remember when I went to the drive-in, we would forget to take the pole out of the window and pull off and break the whole window and drag the pole along behind you at the car, at the drive-in.
If you should accidentally pull a speaker loose, please turn it in at our snack bar or box office. Thanks.
Certainly, my father would be very angry when we would bring home the car with the pole hanging behind it.
Film director John Waters is the author of Make Trouble. He talked with Doug Gordon. Okay, picture this. A young woman sits down at a table with two tape recorders and 20 knives. She spreads one hand out on the table, picks up a knife, and starts stabbing in between her fingers. When she misses and cuts a finger, she picks up a new knife and starts again. In the meantime, she's also recording the sound of this exercise. And at a certain point, she replays the tape, and she starts stabbing in between her fingers in time to the recording, complete with the same mistakes. There's a lot of blood. This event launched the career of the world's most famous performance artist, Marina Abramović. For more than 40 years, she's been testing her limits and the boundaries of what is both permissible and physically possible in art. Steve Paulson caught up with her to talk about her childhood in communist Yugoslavia and about that first bloody breakthrough performance.
So that must have been very painful, right?
Yeah, but this was not the point in these days. You know, we are talking early 70s. You have to go back into the time when the body was the center of the work and performance artists was exploring the physical limits and the pain was not the point. You just have to kind of swallow the pain. You know, blood was a paint and razor plates was a tool and whips was tool. It was a tool to tell the story, just like a painter will have the brush.
Were you nervous before you would go into these performance spaces?
Nervous would be mildly put it. I was terrified. And the fear is start not just in the moment before, start with days and days before. That kind of crumbling the stomach and feeling sick and I will have terrible migraine, whatever is happening, always something terrible happen. And then every time experience the same. The moment stepping into the performance field, almost the same second, everything disappears. It's like I'm entering to another different marina body. And when you actually let it go in this way, it's the most wonderful reward you can have.
It sounds like you're being transported into, I don't know, some other dimension, some different state of consciousness.
Yeah, I really call this higher consciousness. You know, you're working from the highest part of yourself, but it takes every atom of your energy. And then you go back to lowest self possible.
And in another piece you did, Rhythm 5, where you had lit this whole star and
just 100 liters of petrol, which is lots of petrol.
So you climbed in the middle of it and this whole thing was burning around you. What happened then?
No, first, we have to go back a little bit. Why is 5-point star? Because of communism and because that 5-point star was in my birth certificate. And also 5-point star is something to do with restrictions, control, you know, no free speeches and so many of things that I have to kind of free myself. I want to be free from all this.
And you had grown up with all kinds of restrictions.
Concerning my family, my mother and so on. So then I built this 5-point star from the wooden structure and filled with the sawdust soaked in 100 liters of petrol. I had the empty space inside the star, so I jump in, I want to lie in the star till the star burn and just stay, you know, kind of the trace of my body in. But nobody told me that actually oxygen can be taken completely away from that. It was lots of fire. So I go in, I lie down, and I lost consciousness. It was a doctor in the audience see that the flickering of the fire was falling on my feet and I didn't react. So something was wrong. It took me out.
So they jumped into the middle of the fire and pulled you out.
I was so angry. I was so angry that the body have limits, you know. And I'm looking back now and I say, oh my God, that was so much work and I could not do any other way because I have to do all these things to explore my physical limits, to come to the point to understand my mental limits.
But I mean, the other thing that's happening, I assume, is you don't exactly know what's going to happen in some of these performances, and you don't know how the audience is going to react either. I mean, like the people jumping in the middle of the fire and pulling you out. I mean, I guess that becomes part of the performance, right?
You know, first of all, you can't rehearse this, and you will never know how it's going to turn out. But that's what gives this directness and freshness to performance. It's not like theater piece that you rehearse, you know, your position of light, you know, the curtain come down, the ketchup is the blood, and performance is a real one. Here, when you step in the space of performance, everything would happen in that space is a part of it. If electricity stops, earthquakes happen, the war starts, whatever is the part of that work. So, and then you go in and go out.
So another piece you did not that long after the one you've just been describing was Rhythm 0, which sounded even more dangerous, if that's possible. Tell me about that. Tell me about the premise of that.
So the Rhythm 0 piece was, you know, just came from this public experience that, and criticism that, you know, we are masochist, performance art is not any kind of art, you have to be put in mental hospital. So by creating the piece where I'm standing in the middle of the gallery and I have 72 objects in the front for pleasure and for a pain, including pistol with one bullet, and the little instruction, I am an object, you can do anything you want with me, and if you want to kill me, I take all responsibility.
And you're going to sit there for 6 hours?
And 6 hours standing, not sitting. That was just standing. And if you put my head up, I put my head up. If you split my legs, carry me around the gallery, I'm just completely in your hands. It was hell, the piece, so much more difficult. I know my own limits, but here it was the public. And I understood after this work that the public is the one who can kill you. You can never trust the public.
But if you are putting Well, tell me some of the tools. I mean, you already mentioned the pistol with the bullet, but you had a whip and, I mean, all kinds of things.
Okay, let me start with the nice ones, like a rose, like a pair of shoes, grapes, beautiful smell, soap, what else? Feather. And then other side will be hammer, needles, chains, what else? Oh, my God. Razors, sharp instruments that you can penetrate the body, scalpel. So really bad stuff. And pistol with a bullet. So public can choose.
But if you do put some of those things out there and basically say, do whatever you want with me, with my body,
yeah.
Aren't you daring people to see how far they'll go? Is it an invitation for the audience to be violent?
Yeah, but I was ready to die. I was definitely ready to die because how I should be sure that somebody not to put bullet in my head. But I was young and I needed to do this. I needed to know where I am. What is the responsibility of public? What is the responsibility of an artist? And also this was such a fresh art form.
Well, so the way you write about this is for the first 3 hours, they were pretty nice.
Very nice.
And then towards the end, they started getting more violent. They ripped off your clothes. They started stabbing you. And then it got even worse.
Yeah. It was frightening. And, you know, the moment 6 hours was gone, I was full of blood and water and tears and dirt and half naked.
But you didn't mention one thing where there was one man who actually put the bullet in the gun. He held the gun up to your head?
Yes, and he opened the trigger. But another came completely hysterical to start fighting and throw the gun away. But it was very close, very close. It's funny when you're in this kind of state and you really say, okay, I'm taking responsibility, and you're really open to destiny in a very strange way. It's like, if I'm supposed to be killed, I'm meant to be. If I'm not, I don't. I felt like I was given another life after this piece.
I can imagine, yes. When you experienced the kind of pain that you sometimes had in doing some of these performances, once you sort of got through the pain, what happens when you sort of come out on the other side, when you realize, okay, I can live with this pain?
It's the most liberating and the most wonderful experience. You want to just have ice cream or be very tender to yourself. But if you just think of old cultures, any of these shamanistic cultures from the Amazon, Aborigines, Tibetans, they go through these initiations who are dealing almost with the clinical state of dying, in order to have the different state of consciousness. So the pain is like a door of the secrets that you have to go through.
You're talking about transcendence here.
Yeah, definitely. And it's all these cultures deal with the physical pain as one of the first step to have to go through.
That's interesting, because one of your more recent performances, The Artist is Present, which you're best known for now, in 2010 at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, where you sat in a chair with hundreds of people who would come day after day. And you sit there for what, 7 hours a day?
Oh, no, I wish 8 hours a day and 10 hours on Friday. Museum is open 10
for,
hours.
For 3 months.
Yeah.
Obviously, an incredible feat of endurance. What were you trying to do there?
You know, that performance was really an experiment to see if I can transmit unconditional love to total stranger.
So people could come and sit in front of you for however long they wanted. It could be a few minutes, it could be hours.
The idea was to be unconditionally there for them, give them everything I have, and being vulnerable and humble. And that was all.
So often, a total stranger comes and sits down in front of you and starts crying. Why? What happens
there? What do you think? I want to know your explanation.
I don't know. I'm asking you.
You come to the museum. You start waiting in the line. That line can go a few hours. So the waiting is the process already and is a part of the piece. So you come in the front of me and you sit in the chair. I look at you. You're observed by me, but you're also observed by all the public around you. You're also filmed and photographed. You're nowhere to go. There's no escape. So there is no phone. There is no computer. There is no texting messages. Time stops. The first time you get this incredible connection to your own self. Everything comes out, the pain, the loneliness, the everything. It is so unbelievable. And I'm there completely ready to take everything in. And, you know, the eyes are like, the door of the soul. Plus, we don't exchange words. It's not verbal conversation. It's all about emotions.
Now, there are so many things that were so remarkable about that piece at MoMA, the artist is present.
But look how simple it is.
It's so simple, but it's just, I mean, just the feat of endurance. And it's worth pointing out, you were in your 60s at the time.
65.
And you are, I mean, hour after hour sitting there. You never get up to go to the bathroom. You don't eat anything. Just that emotional intensity, not to mention sitting in a chair hour after hour, which I'm sure was very painful.
Extremely painful. It was more difficult than any other piece I ever made. Because if you just try to sit 3 hours without motion on the chair, you see what that means. But sit 3 months is like, it was so hard, especially after 10 hours. I could not have energy to lift my hands to take the dress off. My legs were swollen. I was like, wow, I could not be touched to be massaged or anything. It was just one big pain. But when I sit there, everything disappears. Only when I stopped, I start feeling that. And I trained this like a NASA training for the spaceship, you know. I have to train to drink water in the night, go to the bathroom in the night, to never have lunch. It was one year training to be able to do this.
It sounds just totally exhausting.
Yeah, but the reward was incredible. You can show the power, transformative power of performance art to the general public.
You want to change people. You want to transform people through that experience of art.
I do. I really do, because I think the only way to change the how world looks like and what we are doing right now in the world, it's to change first yourself. By me, by changing myself, I can change thousands. But anything is good, because it's so easy to criticize how things are. But what you do personally, what you do on your own personal level, this is my tool I'm using to do my own work. And if everybody uses own tools, whatever they are, if they're bakers are making the bread or gardeners making the garden, and do it the best possible way, the society will look different. The way to change the world is the only way is to change consciousness. It's no other way.
It's incredibly inspiring. Thank you so much.
This was nice. We done it already. I didn't even finish my tea.
That was terrific. Thank you. What a pleasure.
That's performance artist Marina Abramović talking with Steve Paulson. Her memoir is called Walking Through Walls. And coming up, do you remember the first time you were utterly transported, blown away by a piece of art?
I remember the exact moment, actually. It was in Jamie Hamby's car going to a high school football game my sophomore year. And we were listening to Dr. Feelgood by Motley Crue. And Jamie Hamby had this tricked out Trans Am that was dangerously loud. I probably still have hearing damage from it. And he was like smoking a cigarette or doing something too that just seemed like totally out of bounds. And I just remember feeling like complete powerlessness to the danger of the music and the danger of the situation. I just felt myself kind of like disappear in it.
Composer William Britell is still breaking rules in his own music after this. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. NPRX. I grew up listening to classical music. My father's a music historian, and my personal music library includes a lot of Gregorian chant and chamber music. Until fairly recently, contemporary classical meant, to me, someone still alive playing music written by someone dead. But there's a new generation of classically trained composers who, I guess you could call them genre resistant. They're not fusion, not crossover, they're post-genre. For instance, William Britell, who started writing music secretly when he was barely out of elementary school.
It was more of like a survival mechanism. I grew up very in a religious environment in a very small town in the South, and it just wasn't, you know, writing music was sort of associated with wimpiness and, you know, it was like the opposite of football on the spectrum of acceptability.
No sacrifice.
William Britell went on to music school and grad school, and he's worked in classical, jazz, and punk rock. He's a co-founder of New Amsterdam Records, the leading force in the indie classical scene, and his own music crosses so many boundaries, it's hard to categorize.
I think my experience up until late 20s was doing jazz or doing punk rock or doing classical or experimental classical or whatever, and kind of being convinced at any given time that that was the thing that I wanted to do and diving really headfirst into it and then sort of switching back and forth. And then at some point, I got focused on the punk rock part, but then I blew out my voice.
I wanted to ask you about that. What happened?
Well, there were a lot of bad decisions. You know, it was like the run-of-the-mill bad rock decisions, you know, of not taking care of myself and then not knowing how to sing and screaming. And I developed dysphonia, where your muscles cramp as a way of protecting your voice. But it, in many ways, is the best thing that ever happened to me. I was working in a rock club at the time. I had to quit, and I moved back home, and all I could do was play the piano. You know, I couldn't even
Could you talk?
No, for 6 months, I couldn't talk.
For 6 months, you couldn't even talk?
Yeah. So my wife had to order. I mean, we weren't married at that time yet, but she would have to order food for me. And I just moved home to my parents' house, you know, which was demoralizing in some ways. But, you know, I got home, and I had, like, a mohawk. I remember my dad saying, like, I am cool with all this, but you need to shave your head if you're going to... Like, because he knew me.
But I'm just so struck at what this must have meant for you for a musician to be silenced. I mean, yes, I know you could play the piano and you could make music, but that's like the universe giving you a pretty strong kind of direction.
Then after that, I punched the refrigerator and broke my right hand. So I was like down to a left hand. So I wrote this album of just like left hand piano music. And that was sort of like the pivot point. You know, I was like down to just like five fingers. But it was great too. And then when I came back, when I started to be able to talk, that's when I wrote this piece, Mohar Time Warp, which is kind of like my first work that I feel like is reflective of what I'm trying to do. I remember I was on the subway, and that piece opens with just me yelling bam 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 over and over, and just it's just this kind of cathartic just. I'm just going to do whatever the hell I want to do. And if I like Def Leppard, great. And if I like Xenakis, great. All those things are just, that's it. I'm allowed to do whatever I want to do. And so much of what I've done since that point is creating that space for myself and also trying to be really passionate about other people having that opportunity too.
Yeah, I mean, I what I hear you saying is that dissolving genre can be not just a way of composing, but a way of living.
You know, it's almost like I feel some parallels to gender, to the idea that someone, when we're talking about gender, we're not really talking about, genitals anymore. Mm-hmm. We're talking about behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. And people should be allowed to decide the coding of their behavior. And I think with genre, it's similar. Like, if I have a guitar in something, I'm not trying to say anything about rock music. I'm just trying to express myself.
So I've read that lately you're interested in wanting to make music experiences, you know, way past the black box concert and even past the club. So what is it that you're looking for now in terms of music as an immersive experience?
I like the idea of trying to do things musically that get at... here's an example. So I'm writing a piece now that's being commissioned by the Cherokee Nation in Western North Carolina, and I'm from North Carolina, and spending time with them has made me realize that there are completely different ways to conceptualize our existence on Earth. You know, they organize things in terms of space instead of time, for example. There's no such thing as spirituality because there's no, they don't create a binary between non-spiritual things and spiritual things. Life is spiritual. The side of the bed that you get out of in the morning is spiritual. Everything is based on mindfulness. We use mindfulness to mean, like, I'm going to meditate and then I might do better on this test or whatever it is. You know, it's not about, like, our relationship with the earth and each other. They have no concept of self except in relation to community.
Is that changing how you think about music?
Yes, very much. It's changing what I want music to feel like. I think art so often becomes this intellectual thing, and then you go out and have dinner after. I don't want somebody to go have dinner. You know, like, artistic experiences that I've had are the most powerful. They loosen you up so you can reconceptualize. So they challenge the assumptions that are under all of your assumptions. And they lead you to a place of freedom where you feel smaller in the world, you feel a sense of powerlessness, and it gives you the freedom to rethink who you are and rethink how you can exist. So these are obviously really lofty goals, and I don't know how it fits in with music.
I read somewhere that you've actually been thinking about writing a piece to be listened to in a sensory deprivation tank?
Right, yeah. So I am interested in sensory deprivation tanks, although it's...
What's it like? I've never been in one.
So at this point, I would say my first experience wasn't great. If you do go, just some suggestions. Don't put your hands in your eyes because it's way saltier than you think it's going to be. Any cuts on your body, super burn. I don't like getting water in my ears, so that was an issue. So I kind of, my experience was like having salt in my eyes, burning cuts, and then like not, and then trying to avoid getting water. You know.
Well, but aside from those little things, did you have a transcendent experience? Did you feel like your mind altered in any way?
No, I didn't.
Then why do you want to make music for it?
I think like one of the things that am starting to think is that maybe this separation between mind and body in a concert experience is one of the issues. Like, you know, one thing that I like about rock music, you know, I'm too old for rock shows now. I get like, you know, I just don't like standing up that long and I don't really like beer and it's just not a thing. But the movement associated with it is nice. You know, the fact that you're feeling it with your body and I miss that. I mean, it's hard, even with classical concerts that I have, you know, with the piece we just listened to, I want to move. I want to feel some kind of movement with it, and it's not conducive for that. You know, sensory deprivation, like having that disappear is one option, but it also could be interesting to just put people's bodies in different situations that cause them to listen differently or open up to it in different ways.
Well, I was wondering if you were interested in creating music for a sensory deprivation tank because you were feeling like everything we bring to music, we have all these associations. We bring the past to it every time we sit down to music, no matter where we are. And I wondered if you were just wanting to erase everything.
That's interesting. I like that.
And start in
Can I
pure
use that?
Silence.
I'll quote you. I like that. Yeah.
William Pretel is a composer and co-director of New Amsterdam Records. His albums include Mohair Time Warp, Loving the Chambered Nautilus, and he's got a new single out, Dream Has No Sacrifice. That's it for our conversation on how far is too far when it comes to art. Coming up, novelist Yi-Yun Lee talks about suicidal depression and her decision to become a writer after starting out as a scientist. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. Sometimes the boundaries and definitions you have to break to make art are all your own. Novelist Yi-Yun Lee started out as a scientist. She grew up in China, then moved to the States. Today she's a MacArthur genius whose books have been translated into more than 20 languages. And she's always insisted that her work is not autobiographical. But now she's come out with a memoir called Dear Friend, From My Life, I Write to You in Your Life. And in it, she reveals a lot, including two recent suicide attempts. Yi-Yun Lee told Steve Paulson how and why she took the step of writing directly about her own life.
When writing fiction, it's easier to hide behind the characters, behind everything. I was trying to erase myself as much as I could from the fiction. But I think hiding is not a best way for a writer. That's how I felt when I started writing this book. Because this book was written after some difficult time. You know, I think the whole point is for this book is not to hide anymore.
Hmm. So was writing the book part of your healing process?
You could say that, or you could say it's part of an argument against myself. You know, I think there are so many ways to look at mental illness, and I was an immunologist before I was a writer. And I look at the 2 or 3 years of this extreme situation as an autoimmune disease of the mind, which means whatever feelings my mind felt or created, it was always becoming the target of my own thinking. And while I was working on the book, I thought, well, the only thing I could do was just see how I can target my mind with analysis rather than just irrational feelings. So you have to open up all the wounds before they can heal.
Well, there's a passage in your book that gets at how complicated it is to write about suicide. And I'm wondering if you could read that.
Yes. Death, except for someone entirely isolated, is always a personal moment made public. Suicide, among the most private decisions one can make, is often taken over by the public. Those who express strong feelings mistake themselves as the center of the story. The intense emotions around suicide, anger, pity, unforgivingness, even condemnation, demand what no one has the right to claim. An explanation. A suicide can be dismissed as a drama gone awry and entering the realm of melodrama. If a tragedy makes us weep out of compassion, and a comedy makes us laugh out of appreciation, a melodrama alienates and discomforts. It meets no one's expectation, but its internal need to feel. My intention is not to defend suicide. I might have done so at another time in my life, but I have arrived at a point where defending and disputing my actions are the same argument. Everything I say is scrutinized by myself, not only the words and their logic, but also my motives. A self dissecting itself finds little repose.
So we should back up for a moment and talk about how you became a novelist, because it's a pretty remarkable story. I mean, you took a very unlikely path to get to this point.
Yes.
You grew up in China. Did you ever think about becoming a novelist while you were growing up?
No, I had never thought about writing. When I was young, I was a mathematics genius, little, you know, prodigy. So I was trained as a mathematician when I was young. And I was a scientist. I thought I was going to become the Madame Curie of China. Yeah, I know. It didn't happen. I'm sorry. I disappointed everyone. But I came to America to become an immunologist. And I happened to land in Iowa City, Iowa, where everybody writes. So I just took a couple writing classes, and I really fell in love with writing. And it took me a few years to leave my science career and to become a writer.
So you were, what, 23 when you left China to come to the U.S.?
Yes, I was 23. And I was 30 when I really started seriously to become a writer.
Hmm. Now, going back to your time in China, because you spend a lot of time in this book writing about China, and a lot of it is about your difficult relationship with your mother, who I gather was a very controlling presence as you were growing up.
Yes, my mother is a controlling figure, and partly I think she has this overwhelming love for me, and she's almost a child in a way. And ever since I was probably, I would say 4 or 5, I think she was relying on me to be her mental caretaker, and that created a lot of burdens and tensions between us.
So she was always there, kind of looking over you, criticizing you, probably, in terms of, you know, how you were living. Is that partly why you wanted to leave China, just to get away from that?
Yes, absolutely. When I was 10, I knew the only thing I wanted to do was to go to America, because that way I could leave home. I could stop living in Beijing, where, of course, my parents still live. And I think, yes, you're right. She's always been there. She's this huge presence. And I think what troubles her is I don't love her enough. So that's where she always says I'm selfish, because I cannot, you know, I cannot return my love as she loves me.
So to skip ahead then to the story of, you know, you come to America, you are training to be an immunologist. I mean, you actually are working in a science lab for a while, but then you start taking writing classes and you realize, you know, you want to be a writer. And I mean, you say that there was this period of a few years where you were working in the lab during the day, and I think you had some kids, you had young kids at the time.
Yes.
And you would write each night between midnight and 4 a.m?
Yes. Yes. And I said in the book, I was greedy. I wanted everything. So I needed a full-time job. I wanted to take care of my two young children, but I also wanted to write. So when you have young children, there's really no time. But from midnight to four, that's almost the only time I could get away from my life to focus on writing. So I did for about 10 years of that.
Wow, 10 years up in the middle of the night. Wow.
I know, but then I think, you know, of course, you know, in the past few years, we have seen so much research about sleep deprivation, how that can affect people's mental situation, mental condition. And I do think the lack of sleep probably contributed to this downward, you know, spiral a few years ago.
Huh. There are so many interesting parts of this story that you're telling. And one is your decision to write in English. I mean, basically rejecting your native language of Chinese. Why did you want to write in English?
Yes. I had never written in Chinese. I always have this, I would say, you know, complicated, even, you know, intense relationship with Chinese language. I grew up memorizing all these Asian poems, and I could use the language well. I call it public language, really propaganda language, was used in everyday life. And I had a strong dislike of that kind of language. So I had never thought about writing. And when I was in China, I could write propaganda well. I was in the army. I could write beautiful propaganda. So English, however, you know, it's this language that I took up as my language. So I call English my first language in writing, but English is also just a language that I use to think and to sort through everything in life. I think English provides this space, or I create this space with English for myself, that I did not do that with my native language.
Hmm. Well, you get at some of this in a passage in the book, and I'd love to have you read that. What you do in Chinese, what you do in English.
Yes. Over the years, my brain has banished Chinese. I dream in English. I talk to myself in English. And memories, not only those about America, but also those about China. Not only those carried on, but also those archived with the wish to forget, are sorted in English. To be orphaned from my native language felt, and still feels, a crucial decision. I have declined to have my books translated into Chinese, which is understood by some as odiously pretentious. Once in a while, my mother will comment, hinting at my selfishness, that I have deprived her of the pleasure of reading my books. But Chinese was never my private language, and it will never be. That I write in English doesn't make me part of something else. The verdict of my professor in graduate school was that I was writing in a language that did not belong to me, hence I would not and should not belong. But this protest was irrelevant. I have not been using the language to be part of something. When we enter a world, a new country, a new school, a party, a family, or a class reunion, an army camp, a hospital, we speak the language it requires. Perhaps the line between the two languages, the public and the private, is and should be fluid. It is never so for me. I often forget when I write that English is also used by others. English is my private language. Every word has to be pondered over before it becomes my word. I have no doubt can this be an illusion, that the conversation I have with myself, however linguistically flawed, is the conversation that I have always wanted, in the exact way I want it to be.
That is so fascinating. Do you consider yourself an American writer or a Chinese writer, or do those labels not matter to you?
I am American writer by training, which means I became a writer in America. But I never really think about these labels. You know, sometimes I say I would like to be called an international writer. I think that might be the best to describe me. But, you know, that doesn't even count as much. I think I just want to say I'm a writer.
Lee-Yoon Lee's new book is called Dear Friend, From My Life, I Write to You in Your Life. She talked with Steve Paulson. And that's it for today's show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced this hour, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, Mark Rickers, and audio engineer Steve Gotcher. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.